And that brings us to the end of another edition of Global Revolutions. What you just heard in that set was Portuguese and Portuguese-speaking music, regions of the world conquered by the Portuguese. Chilina de Piedade doing Acordeão do Sá, featuring the Basque accordionist Kepa Junqueira, an album called Em Casa. Then over to Brazil, Sinforró with Camarão doing Retrato de Forró. Camarão, the imaginary soundtrack to a Brazilian Western movie, 1964-1974. Then it was Roger doing Retumbar do Meu Tambor from his Curiman record. And ending with a Cape Verde song with João Cirilo Poditerra, Space Echo, the mystery behind the cosmic sound of Cabo Verde finally revealed. And it was my great honor to have Srivam Simata about his show, Can a Song Be a Revolution, happening at the Play Circle this Thursday at UW-Madison at 7:30. This has been Global Revolutions with Martin Alvarado. You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison, Wisconsin, listener-sponsored community radio.
Hello. Palestinians who've returned to the wrecked city of Khan Yunis in Gaza have spoken of the devastated landscape they found after months of intense fighting there. Many people came home to find that their houses were in ruins, with others saying they couldn't actually locate their homes.
I went to check if my home's still standing, but it is hardly anything left of it. There's no stairs to get to it. My brother managed to climb up there and get us some clothes for my children.
We came to check our house. We didn't find anything. My house and my neighbor's house are flattened. I just wanted to find a place to stay with my family, but there is nothing. Thanks God for everything.
Israel says its troops had been pulled back in preparation for the next stage of the conflict. It also announced the entry of more than 300 aid trucks into Gaza. A spokesman for the Qatari government has told the BBC he's cautiously optimistic about progress at talks in Cairo on a ceasefire in Gaza in return for the release of Israeli hostages. Majid Mohammed al-Ansari said he was encouraged by a new proposal that may bridge the long-standing gap between the two opposing sides.
There is a proposal at the moment which we find to be encouraging. We are waiting for the reply from both sides, of course. Obviously, the situation is still very difficult and fluid on the ground. We are by no means at the last stretch of these talks, but if you ask me if I'm more optimistic today than I was a couple of days ago, I would say yes.
Large groups of people are gathering in the Mexican town of Mazatlan, where a total solar eclipse is due to start in about an hour's time. The eclipse will then move on to the United States and finish in Canada. The moon will perfectly block the sun and the sky will go pitch dark for 4 minutes. Donald Trump has said abortion rights should be decided by individual U.S. states and has resisted pressure from conservative Republicans for an outright ban. The Republican presidential candidate claimed credit for a Supreme Court decision 2 years ago, ending the federal right to abortion. President Biden accused Mr. Trump of scrambling to limit the damage done by his stance on abortion. Here's Tom Bateman in Washington.
I think it shows that Donald Trump is vulnerable on this issue. He took his time. He made a sort of pre-planned and pre-trailed announcement on this in a very sort of un-Trump-like way, a way that we're not necessarily used to. The Biden campaign, they are already exploiting this for everything they've got. They're saying that Donald Trump had ripped away a fundamental right for women in America. Mr. Biden saying that women were in the extraordinary position under Donald Trump, where they have fewer rights than their mothers and grandmothers had.
Tom Bateman reporting from Washington. This is the World News from the BBC. The Vatican has issued a strong warning about gender theory, arguing that sex change surgery risks the unique dignity of a person which is bestowed at conception. The declaration, which was signed by Pope Francis, also reiterates the Church's opposition to surrogate parenthood, abortion and euthanasia. The Vatican has faced a huge backlash from Roman Catholic conservatives in recent months for its stance on LGBT issues. Médecins Sans Frontières has made an urgent appeal for humanitarian agencies that have suspended work in Sudan to return to the country. Nearly a year after fighting began between rival military factions, MSF said a colossal humanitarian crisis was taking place. Nearly 5 million people face hunger. An American executive with the world's biggest cryptocurrency exchange, Binance, has appeared in court in Nigeria to plead not guilty to money laundering. Tigran Gambaryan also denied a charge of operating without a license at the hearing in Abuja. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has joined the social media platform TikTok. His first post, which is captioned, "I'm just as surprised as you are," tracks someone walking into an empty office before cutting to Mr. Scholz sitting at his desk. Nikki Cardwell reports.
To the sound of a bassoon, Olaf Scholz made his debut on TikTok, 13 seconds that showed more of his Spartan office than of the man himself. He's not the first politician to join TikTok. Presidents Biden and Macron and the man known as the TikTok Taoiseach, Ireland's Simon Harris, all have their own channels. But Mr. Scholz will be hoping to avoid the fate of the former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, whose TikTok channel gave his critics a way to troll him, including one who said, "TikTok is not for politicians. It's for people to take the mickey out of politicians."
Nikki Cardwell reporting, and that's the latest BBC News.
Spring has sprung and vegetable seedlings are quickly growing. Fair Share CSA Coalition will get the conversation flowing. Tune in to the Access Hour on Monday, April 8th at 7 p.m. to hear about the hard work it takes to get local food on your plate. You'll learn lots about community-supported agriculture and vegetable farming. Hear stories from staff, farmers, and apprentices. Oh, how charming. We want to build resilient local food communities. Who knows? Maybe you'll learn an innovative farming technique. Or you'll be signing up for a CSA next week. That's the Access Hour on Monday, April 8th at 7 p.m. on WORT Madison.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to place.
Good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair. I'm Christina Leffring, news and politics editor at Tone Madison, filling in for Douglas Haynes. Like many cities across the country, Madison is experiencing growing pains stemming from a housing shortage and growing population. The city's population grew by nearly 37,000 people between 2010 and 2020, but built little more than 16,000 housing units during that same time period. Projecting that growth into the future, some experts estimate that the city will need to build 10,000 new homes every 5 years just to keep up, which is not easy to do in a city that is predominantly zoned for single-family homes. Up until the end of 2022, 75% of Madison's residential neighborhoods were zoned for single-family homes. Since then, the city has made an effort to loosen up restrictions in order to promote density in all neighborhoods. But there's been pushback, particularly from homeowners. What those homeowners may not realize is their neighborhoods are a direct result of segregationist housing policies, and those policies have had rippling effects on housing, education, and generational wealth. Richard Rothstein is now a mostly retired researcher and writer and has written several books on education. In 2017, he published The Color of Law, which detailed local, state, and federal laws and policies that force segregate Americans into segregated housing. Richard and his daughter, Leah Rothstein, an expert on housing policy and community development, co-wrote Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law, which was published last year. Richard Rothstein, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So first, I want to talk about The Color of Law for people who have not read the book. Your goal was to demonstrate that segregation is, quote, not the unintended consequence of individual choices or otherwise well-meaning law or regulation, but of unhidden public policy that explicitly segregated every metropolitan area in the United States. Why did you feel it was important for people to understand that segregation was not de facto, but de jure?
Well, the purpose of The Color of Law was to demolish that de facto myth, the idea that the reason that we're a segregated society is because of private discrimination or redlining by banks or real estate agents or insurance companies, or maybe because people just like to live with each other of the same race, or maybe economic differences. All of these unintentional consequences of segregation give us no responsibility to remedy it. once we understand that it was not these private activities, but it was government at all levels, federal, state, and local, that were designed to ensure that African Americans and whites could not live near one another in any metropolitan area, once we understand that, it imposes an obligation upon all of us as Americans to remedy it. These were unconstitutional and unlawful policies on the part of government at every level. And when you have an unconstitutional policy, when you have a violation of constitutional rights, we have an obligation to remedy it. So it's very important that people understand this history, because if we think it all happened by accident or by private activity, we can only imagine that it can unhappen by accident or by private activity. Once we understand it was a racially explicit policy of government, that changes entirely the obligation that we have to fix it.
Yeah, I think you also mentioned that it really hides this history of multiracial communities that did exist in the United States and then were forcibly separated from one another. And, you know, it reinforces this idea that people do not want to live in such communities, or that these communities cannot thrive, or that there's some kind of inherent reason why we can't live together.
Yes, I don't want to exaggerate the extent to which we are an integrated society in the mid-early 20th century. We were not, but we did have broad urban areas that were multiracial. We were a manufacturing economy. Factories had to be located near deep water ports or railroad terminals to get their parts or ship their final products. And both African-American and white workers needed to live close enough to those factories in order to be able to walk to work or maybe take short streetcar rides. Same thing is true of the banks and the insurance companies that service those factories, those manufacturing facilities. So in a broad sense, we were a non-segregated society, although there were certainly pockets of segregation within those urban areas. But the federal government embarked on many programs. One of them that I think you were referring to is the first public housing in this country. The first public housing in this country was built in the New Deal, the first civilian government housing. During the Depression, the Roosevelt administration, we had never had any public housing before that. And the government created that public housing on a segregated basis. And I'm not referring to the South, I'm referring to the North, to the Midwest. The government created separate projects for whites and African Americans, frequently creating segregation where it hadn't previously existed. In The Color of Law, I described the autobiography of Langston Hughes, the great African American poet, novelist, playwright. He wrote in his autobiography that he grew up in an integrated downtown Cleveland neighborhood. That's not how we think of downtown Cleveland today. He said his best friend in high school was Polish. He said he dated a Jewish girl in high school. He went to an integrated high school in an integrated neighborhood, something that doesn't exist anymore in downtown Cleveland. And the federal government went into that neighborhood, demolished some housing, and built two separate projects, one for African Americans, one for whites, creating a segregation pattern that was much more rigid than anything that previously existed. And then with other public housing projects elsewhere in the Cleveland area, further intensified that segregation, building separate projects for whites and African Americans. And this went on all over the country.
Yeah, this was also something that happened with urban renewal projects. I think in Madison specifically, about we had a neighborhood called Greenbush. And I mean, the neighborhood still exists, but before it was part of an urban renewal project, it was a multiracial community.
Yeah, so the federal government typically considered those communities slums. And the idea was to redevelop those communities by demolishing the housing of lower income families and building colleges and schools and museums and other amenities for what were increasingly middle-class families commuting to the cities from what were all white suburbs. And the whole story of those all white suburbs, which you referred to in your introduction about zoning, was also an explicit racial creation of the federal government. You're probably familiar with this. There are suburbs all over the country that are exclusive, as you mentioned, single family homes only, whites only. This was part of a federal program. These creation of these suburbs everywhere were a federal program to move the whites out of those urban areas that I described before, those multiracial areas, into single family homes in suburbs, and prohibit African Americans from doing the same, even though their incomes were comparable. They were particularly aimed at returning war veterans in the period after World War II. The most famous of these developments was, and you've probably heard of it, Levittown. I describe it in detail in The Color of Law. 17,000 homes in one place, an enormous project. No bank would lend William Levitt, the developer, the funds to buy the land and build this enormous suburban project. They didn't think anybody was going to buy us houses because we weren't a suburban country at that time. The only way that Levitt, and this is true of developers everywhere in the country, in Wisconsin and Illinois and the West Coast, anywhere, the only way that the developers could build these projects, as Levitt did, was to go to the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administrations, requesting a guarantee of his bank loans, because the banks wouldn't give him the loans otherwise to build the projects. He had to, in order to get this guarantee, he had to submit his plans for the development in detail to the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administration. He had to describe the architectural design of the homes in great detail, the materials he was going to use, and make a required commitment required by the federal government that he never sell a home to an African American. This was not the action of rogue bureaucrats. This was a written federal policy. The Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administrations had a manual that was distributed to appraisers all over the country, whose job it was to evaluate the application of builders to create these suburban developments of single family homes. The manual said that you could not recommend for a federal bank guarantee a loan to a developer who was going to sell to African Americans. The manual went so far as to say you couldn't even recommend for a federal bank guarantee a loan to an all-white developer, a developer of all-white homes, if it was going to be located near where African Americans were living. Because in the words of the federal policy manual, the written policy manual, and I cite this in The Color of Law, the manual said that that would run the risk of infiltration by inharmonious racial groups. So that's how these suburbs that you were referring to before were created. Well, African Americans could have afforded to move to those suburbs just as easily as whites, or almost as easily as whites. Returning war veterans all could have afforded those homes. They were inexpensive. All these suburbs initially were created as modest working class homes, typically two bedrooms, one bath homes, Levittown and everywhere else. They were inexpensive. They sold at the time for about 1950 or so, for about $8,000, $9,000 a piece. That's not what they sell for today. In today's money, that was $100,000. It's not what they sell for today. You can't buy a home in any of these suburbs for $100,000.
You can't find a house anywhere for $100,000. Gosh, I wish.
$200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $1 million or more in some places for these $100,000 homes. The white families who bought those homes gained wealth, because they had unexpected appreciation in the value of their homes. They didn't expect to get rich by buying these suburban modest houses. There was a housing shortage. They were looking for a place to live. Nobody expected this price appreciation that would take place over the next couple of generations. But the white families who bought those homes gained wealth from the appreciation in the value of their homes. African Americans prohibited by explicit federal policy from buying those same homes in these appreciating neighborhoods. The white families used the wealth to send their children to college. They perhaps took care of temporary emergencies with them, maybe temporary unemployment or maybe a medical emergency. They used it to subsidize their retirements, and they used it to bequeath wealth to their children and grandchildren, who then could buy homes of their own with down payments from that wealth. African Americans, I say, prohibited by explicit federal policy from participating in this program that ended up generating wealth, not intentionally, but ended up generating wealth. And the result is it determines much of the inequality we have today. Once those suburbs were created and those homes appreciated in value, as you said, many of those suburbs then locked in their exclusivity by adopting zoning laws that prohibited the construction of duplexes, triplexes, any kind of multi-unit housing that would be affordable still to working or lower middle class families. And that's how they maintained their racial exclusivity. African Americans could not afford to buy those single family homes once they appreciated in value. They might have been able to buy duplexes and triplexes in those communities, but the zoning laws prohibited that. So this all ties together as the consequences of an unconstitutional, and I want to emphasize that, the federal policies of the Federal Housing Administration and the Veterans Administration were blatant violations of the Constitution, blatant violations of Civil War, Civil Rights Acts that were still in existence at that time. So we have an unconstitutional, it's like an apartheid system. We have an unconstitutional, unlawful arrangement of housing by race in this country that we've never accepted an obligation to remedy. And it's time that we did.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's pretty wild in The Color of Law was that you talked about that policy under the Federal Housing Administration. They continued that policy even after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1948 that restrictive covenants were unconstitutional, and they did it on financial grounds, on value, on like valuation grounds. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure. For a brief period until 1955, even after 1948, the Supreme Court prohibited the enforcement of restrictive covenants. These are deed clauses that the Federal Housing Administration required Levitt to place in these deeds. In 1948, the Supreme Court said you couldn't have a deed clause that prohibited resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. These are called restrictive covenants in these deed clauses. 1948, the Supreme Court said you couldn't enforce them, that you couldn't go to court, neighbors couldn't go to court and order the eviction of African American families who had purchased homes in violation of these deed clauses. But the Supreme Court continued to allow for another 7 years a different kind of restrictive covenant that did require courts to evict African American families, but required the sellers of those homes to pay damages to their neighbors that were far in excess of the value of the homes, so ineffectively maintaining that policy. But that's not the main reason the policy continued. The main way that the policy continued is that the federal government continued to guarantee mortgages, guarantee loans, and to issue mortgages that were being marketed by real estate agents who would only sell to white families. Now, every one of those real estate agents in Wisconsin and every other state of the union is licensed by state government. And every time the federal government contracted with a real estate company to market homes in one of these new developments or financed a developer to build homes in the knowledge that those homes would not be sold, would be sold only to whites because those were the real estate agents who were handling the projects. That was another violation. In this case, a violation both of the federal government for doing it knowingly and state governments for licensing real estate agents who continued the practice of excluding African Americans from these communities when they were still affordable.
Okay. I want to take a step back and talk a little bit about zoning. You wrote about Harlan Bartholomew, who developed comprehensive plans for cities all over the country, including Madison in 1921-22 and Kenosha in 1925. So what was Bartholomew trying to accomplish with zoning, and how did it work?
Yes, in the early 20th century, planners like Bartholomew created segregation explicitly by designating areas that where African Americans lived as being open to industries, frequently polluting industries, commercial development of all kinds, and designating areas where whites live for residential, usually single-family homes, but not necessarily for residential use only. These kinds of explicit racial zonings pretty much fell out of favor in the early 1920s. And that's when the Supreme Court upheld a substitute of non-racial zoning that was in effect designed to exclude families who were not white of the kind that you were talking about before, single family only zones of wealthy, of appreciating homes that became more and more expensive. So we had explicit racial zoning in the early 20th century in many cities. Planners like Bartholomew were hired by cities to create these zoning maps. And then in the mid-1920s, the Supreme Court upheld a purportedly race-neutral substitute, but at that point it had a racial effect, and it was designed in many communities to have a racial effect.
Yeah, I grew up in Kansas City, and so we had J.C. Nichols. And I remember learning, I didn't learn until my late 20s about how the way that, you know, Kansas City has these really pretty boulevards and these parks and golf courses, but those were intentionally placed in areas to separate people by race and by class so that, you know, you would have maintained these exclusive neighborhoods.
Well, yes, and developers like J.C. Nichols, even if they weren't, they developed these communities, like you know, of Kansas City, before the federal government got involved in housing. But they also, the National Association of Realtors at that time had a code of ethics that prohibited the sale of homes in white neighborhoods to African Americans. This is their code of ethics. Any real estate agent, any realtor, any broker, who is licensed by the state of Kansas in your case, or anywhere in Wisconsin, any realtor who was licensed by state government who subscribed to that code of ethics, and any realtor who was a member of the National Association of Realtors would have subscribed to it, was committing the state government was committing a constitutional violation when they licensed those realtors. And that's another aspect of the remedy that is imposed upon us as Americans if we take our constitutional responsibilities seriously.
That was Richard Rothstein. You're listening to A Public Affair on Community Radio WORT 89.9 FM. Today we're talking about housing segregation with Richard Rothstein, the author of Color of Law and co-author of Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Under the Color of Law. So I want to switch to Just Action, which is kind of a companion piece to The Color of Law. It's essentially answering the question of, you know, you learn about The Color of Law, you learn about all these mechanisms that forced segregation into American cities. Now, what do we do about it? In one segment, you talk about like holding people accountable. And not just individuals, I'm talking about like industries in particular. You've mentioned banking, real estate, a lot of industries that have developers that have profited handsomely off of these policies. How would you like to see them be involved with remediating and addressing these issues?
Well, yeah, thank you. We wrote the new book published last year, Just Action, to answer that question. What do we do about the segregation that was unconstitutionally created? And one of the first observations we make is that although much of the segregation that we created was done by the federal government and federal policy, once you have a segregated society, it's local practices and local actors that perpetuate that segregation, sometimes even exacerbating it. And so there's an enormous amount we can do at the local level to redress the segregation that was unconstitutionally created. We begin the book Just Action by describing the necessity of biracial groups organizing to press for local policy change and local actors in order to create redress, and they can accomplish an enormous amount. So one of the policies that we describe, and there are dozens of them in Just Action, in the book Just Action, but one of them stems from the very restrictive covenants that I was describing earlier. The deed clauses in homes that prohibit resale to African Americans. Frequently, these deed clauses identify and are signed by the developer, the realtor, the bank that initially created those suburbs. Many of those are either still in existence today or have successors that are still in existence today. And what we argue is that a local group, if organized, can begin a campaign to get those private institutions that participated with the federal government in creating segregation to come up with the significant funds to remedy it. Many of these institutions have responded by creating DEI programs that promising to hire more Black real estate agents, for example, or Black bank executives. That doesn't do anything to create additional housing opportunities for people who are excluded. What we need is substantial contributions from those institutions that profited and created and can the segregation we know today, and that can be identified. So we give a number of examples in Just Action of communities where people have begun to identify these banks, realtors, developers who created segregation. Charlottesville, Virginia, we describe. Rochester, New York, we describe. San Mateo, California, we describe. In each of these communities, I think there are a couple of others too. Oh yes, Modesto, California. We describe a number of them where you can identify and we name them. The banks, the realtors, the developers, who cannot be identified by their signatures on these restrictive covenants, who created this segregation, and who are not going to, should not be permitted to remedy it simply by creating a more diverse workforce. What they need is to come up with substantial funds to subsidize the movement of African Americans into communities from which they were previously excluded, both by government and by these named institutions.
Yeah. So I want to talk about zoning a little bit again, but partly because this has become such a contentious topic in Madison. So in the past year and a half or so, Madison has made zoning changes to promote density in all neighborhoods in response to our housing shortage. For example, they loosened the single family zoning to include duplexes and accessory dwelling units, granny flats, carriage houses. We had a law that constrained the definition of family, and they've removed that. So more people who are unrelated by blood or marriage could cohabitate. And they've also got something called transit-oriented overlay. So creating zones for higher density that are closer to public transit, as well as just future planning zoning to promote more density in single family neighborhoods. But these efforts have met a good deal of pushback, particularly from homeowners, mostly on the grounds of home values and neighborhood character. How do we get buy-in from homeowners for these dense multiracial neighborhoods?
Well, let me make a couple of points related to your question. We have such an enormous housing shortage today in this country. It does not just affect African Americans. Young white professionals, people forming families, middle class whites, can't afford housing anymore today in the neighborhoods in which they grew up. So simply changing zoning, which we is an essential first step. I'm not minimizing its importance. You can't do anything else until you change the zoning. But it in itself is not going to address the segregation that we've created. Because if we simply permit duplexes and triplexes, sometimes more density along transit corridors, whites are going to outbid African Americans for the housing that's created. There are more housing shortage whites in every community in this country than there are housing shortage African Americans, simply because the white population is so much larger in this country than African Americans. I was speaking a couple of months ago in Boston, Massachusetts, where Massachusetts has issued a law similar to the one you described that creates the authority to build multifamily units, duplexes, triplexes, along transit corridors in the Boston metropolitan area. And the city manager of one of the most elite suburbs in Boston explained that this was a very important reform because the children who grew up in his community need to be able to move back to the community in which they grew up. And that's what this reform would accomplish. Well, he's right. That is what this reform might accomplish. But the people who grew up in those communities are not African Americans. They were excluded. So we need to do more than simply reform zoning, although reforming zoning is an important first step. Now you ask, how do we oppose the resistance? Well, the only way to oppose the resistance is to organize. You know, one of the things that we mention in Just Action is that 20 million Americans participated in Black Lives Matter demonstrations in 2020. They were white and black. Probably more whites participated in those demonstrations than blacks over the course of the whole country. They were both urban and suburban. They were both middle class and lower income families. It was a very diverse group. But then after those demonstrations were over, those people went home. They put Black Lives Matter signs on their lawns or in their windows and did nothing further actually to make Black Lives Matter. So our view is, and this is the view of Just Action, is there's an enormous silent base in this country for redressing the unconstitutional segregation that we created. But it needs to be organized. People need to get together and create the kinds of committees, civil rights groups, reinvigorated civil rights groups that will press for the kinds of reforms that are necessary. We argue that unless we create those kinds of multi-ethnic, biracial committees that are going to take direct action to create pressure on the banks and the realtors and the developers to make sure that we're not simply providing housing for middle-class whites, but for the African-Americans excluded as well. Without that kind of pressure, it's not going to happen. In addition to publishing the book Just Action, we also are writing, my daughter and I, Leah Rothstein, who's the co-author of Just Action, we're writing a frequent Substack column. It's free. You can just go to Substack and find the Just Action Substack. And recently, Leah wrote a column in which she interviewed people in a community, in a very elite white community in the South San Francisco Bay Area, where the community was having trouble retaining teachers, had a 30% teacher turnover every year because nobody could live even on a teacher salary near their schools. So the commutes were too long. They couldn't retain teachers. So the school district had some empty land and it proposed to build multi-unit housing on that empty land. A group of the kinds of residents you described who were claiming it was to change the character of the community. These are for teachers, to change the character of the community. Shouldn't be permitted. They put an initiative on the ballot to prohibit not only this development, proposed by the school district from being created, but any future change in zoning in the community. A group of people in the community who had been studying the history of segregation, they had a study group around the color of law and investigated the history of segregation in their own community. This was one of the places where we identified the bank and the real estate agent and the developer that created the segregation. They were frustrated. They thought that they were hopelessly outnumbered, that this initiative would pass and there would never be any development again, multi-unit development, any breakage in the single-family zoning rules. But they started to go door to door in the community and campaign for the defeat of this initiative. They were stunned by the amount of support that they had, silent support. But when all was said and done, they wound up defeating the initiative in one of the most elite, not my backyard, purportedly communities in the country. So this is what people can do if they organize and don't just talk about it, but actually do something about it, as this group did. And Leah interviewed many of the people who went door to door and their reactions when they found the support that they never expected to find. It was quite and this can be done anywhere in the country.
All right. You're listening to A Public Affair on WORT FM 89.9. We are talking to Richard Rothstein, author of The Color of Law and co-author of Just Action. And we're talking about housing segregation. If you want to join our conversation, that number is 608-256-2001. In our last mayoral election, a candidate who did not win said that we didn't need to change Madison's neighborhoods, but instead needed to focus on home ownership for Black and Brown families. You have a chapter in Just Action that's titled, Is Homeownership the Answer? Can we talk a little bit about like the extent to which homeownership can and cannot address these inequities and segregation?
It is an answer, but some of the discussion that you see in the housing community exaggerates the extent to which it can be the answer. Certainly, increasing opportunities for African Americans to own homes will contribute to the desegregation of our communities. But you need to do some work to make that happen. One, as you mentioned, is zoning change that permits the purchase of homes that might not be single family homes on large lot sizes, that are more denser, but not out of character with the community. That's one way. But there's much that local communities can do to, for example, recruit African Americans to purchase homes that are constructed once those zoning changes are made, to educate African Americans who don't come from families that have for generations owned homes so that they can learn how to do it. This is may seem to be a very obvious thing, but people whose parents haven't owned a home frequently have never thought of how you would go about doing that. There are down payment assistance programs all over the country that most of them run by governments, local governments, that provide down payment assistance to families who can afford to maintain a mortgage, but who don't have the wealth that whites created through the unconstitutional policies I talked about before, that don't have the wealth to create a down payment to buy those homes. And so, but most people don't know about those down payment assistance programs. And so one of the things that needs to be done is educate the African American community, the middle class African American community, working class African American community about their availability to enable them to buy a home. And then, as I said, there are dozens of policies we describe in Just Action. One of them is the discriminatory nature of the credit scoring system. As you know, your ability to get a mortgage depends on how good your credit is. And how good your credit is depends on whether you've faithfully repaid loans you've had in the past. Well, in today's economy, overall, nationally, about 70% of white households own their own homes. About 40% of African Americans own their own homes. The result is that if an African American applies for a mortgage, that African American is less likely than a white to have had a previous mortgage which shows a good credit record, a good payment history. Whites are more likely to have owned a previous home and have had a good credit history if they've repaid their mortgage on time and on a monthly basis. When the credit scores are created, people's faithful mortgage payments are recorded and give them extra points in their credit score. But people's rental payments are not recorded. You could have paid your rent on time every month for your entire life, and you get no points in your credit score for that. The result is that the credit scoring system is discriminatory in effect, not in intent, but in effect, because the kinds of credit that African Americans have is less likely to generate a benefit in your credit score than the kinds of credit that whites have. This is an example of what I was talking about before, of what you can do in a local community to redress segregation. Local banks, local credit unions that issue mortgages could change the way in which they calculate their credit and whether they count the kinds of credit that African Americans have. But unless there's a pressure group in the community, as I described before, a biracial committee, a new civil rights movement that presses those banks and credit unions to count the kinds of credit that African Americans have, it won't happen.
Okay, we have Fawn on hold, and they have a question. Fawn, are you there?
I am. I'm talking while driving, so I'll be up and on my watch, so I'll be very careful. Hi, my name's Fawn, and Richard Rossman, I'm such a fan of yours. I was so moved by your first book, The Color of Law, and recommend it to everybody. And I hadn't seen your second book, but I'll get on that right away. I was so moved that I wanted to partner with the local NAACP to work for housing justice in Madison, and beyond just building more rental apartments, as is being done. Madison has a lot of great programs for first-time home buyers and non-traditional home buyers and so forth, for people with not enough money for a down payment and so forth. So I think that's less of an obstacle here in Madison, but I was struck by your example in The Color of Law about St. Paul and how I think we live in such a class-segregated society, and oftentimes race is a proxy for class, although also vice versa, that the way it would happen in St. Paul is that the barriers for low working class people to desegregate neighborhoods happened before the influx of black residents. So that's how they did that before, you know, racism could get in the way. And then now people of color are some of the beneficiaries of that. We're too late for that in Madison, but I wonder if you have any other thoughts on that kind of situation, because I'd like very much to work with NAACP and other local groups and individuals to really truly integrate and achieve better access for black people to many of the amenities and benefits that are found in white neighborhoods and, you know, schools. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Fawn. As I mentioned, we have dozens of local policies that we describe in Just Action. I'll just give you one now, but there are too many to actually go through in this brief time we have together. But I'll give you an example of another on its face race-neutral policy that's discriminatory in effect, like the credit scoring system. Throughout the country, in Wisconsin and in Madison and everywhere else in the country, the property assessment system that's conducted by counties and cities is racially discriminatory. African Americans pay property taxes, and their landlords pay property taxes, meaning they pay higher rent as a result at a higher rate than whites do. Now, this is not because when an assessor looks at a property, the tax assessor considers the race of the occupant, of the renter or the owner. It's because the system itself is discriminatory in effect. There are many reasons for this. One is, for example, that the way assessment systems work, there's usually a tax assessor or sometimes an elected official, sometimes appointed at the county or city level. They do an assessment, that is a judgment of what the value of the home is. They apply a certain percentage to it that's uniform, but basically they're judging the value of the home. And they adjust it each year by some inflation rate, some constant inflation rate. Over time, the assessed values become outdated. In that period, while the assessed values are becoming outdated, homes in white neighborhoods are appreciating at a faster rate than homes in black neighborhoods are. The result is that over time, increasingly, African Americans are paying property taxes, have an assessed value that's closer to their real market value than white families have, whose assessed values that are remaining relatively stagnant, adjusted maybe for inflation. Their assessed values are farther below their actual market values. The result is that African Americans are paying higher property taxes. This has the effect of excluding African Americans, other African Americans, from the housing market because the houses are unaffordable because of higher property taxes that are not paid in white neighborhoods. Now, this is a purely local issue. Federal government has nothing to do with tax assessors. The only way this will be reformed is with a local civil rights group that's going to conduct campaigns against the way in which property taxes are assessed to eliminate the discriminatory nature of them. African Americans are paying a higher share of the cost of schools and fire departments and libraries and all the things that are paid for by property taxes than whites are relative to the value of their homes. That's just one other example of the kind of policy that's keeping African Americans out of home ownership and extorting higher rents from them as well, because their landlords are also paying higher property taxes relative to the value of their property.
One last kind of question. We've got about 10 minutes left, but so the city has approved a significant amount of new housing construction, but one issue is that a lot of the new construction is not really affordable to low-income and working-class people. And in some cases, naturally affordable housing, because it's older housing, is torn down for more units of this housing. You know, in Just Action, you talk about the importance of investing in Black and Brown neighborhoods in ways that mitigate gentrification and can minimize displacement. How can we build more dense quality housing without displacing lower income residents?
Well, this is a very complex conundrum, because one of the things that we talk about in Just Action is how important it is to improve the resources in Black neighborhoods. But if you improve the resources in Black neighborhoods, whites are going to start to move in. That's what we call gentrification. You can't have it both ways. You can't both keep a neighborhood segregated and make it a healthier neighborhood in terms of the access to good schools and eliminating polluting industries, better quality housing. As it improves, more people are going to want to move in. So you can't eliminate displacement altogether. But what we describe in Just Action are a number of policies that can mitigate it. So what you wind up with is some displacement, but also a healthier, desegregated community in which many, if not most, of the people who previously lived there can remain. So what are those policies? One is a policy which is called, and all of these are followed in a few places, but none in very many places, but there are lots of models for it. One is a policy called inclusionary zoning, which requires any new development to have a share of housing, not just for low-income families, but for middle-income families as well, that previous residents can access. Another is land trusts all over the country, and I believe in Madison as well. There are land trusts that can build affordable housing. The way they do that is they take donations of land from cities or counties or even private philanthropies who donate land on which they can build housing. And the land trust keeps ownership of the land and only sells the house on top of it. Now, as you know, the land is the most expensive, increasingly the most expensive part of the cost of a home. The reason that those homes I described earlier that were sold in the 20th century for $100,000 and now costing $1 million is not because they've somehow remodeled the home with more expensive appliances. That's a tiny part of it. The reason is the land has gone so much more expensive. If you can keep ownership of the land and the trust and just sell the home becomes much more affordable. And then when the homeowner, or you know, they're used for rentals as well, but I'll just say homeowner, the homeowner decides to sell, there's a restriction on how much of an increase in price that homeowner can charge so that it becomes permanently affordable. The homeowner gains some equity from the growth in the value, but there's also a restriction on how much that can be so that the house becomes further becomes affordable as well. So those are just two examples of policies that can prevent massive displacement from a community. And they exist all over the country, but not in sufficient number to do a significant dent in the gentrification that's going on all over.
All right. We've got one last question from a caller. They wanted to know your thoughts on tiny homes available at market rate versus kind of low income or affordable housing. And just what are some of the kind of pros and cons you see to some of these different approaches to making affordable housing?
Well, we have such an enormous housing crisis, as I said before, that we need all kinds of housing to be built that we don't presently have. I think by tiny homes, you're referring to things like accessory dwelling units, for example, that are authorized in many places. We need those, but those accessory dwelling units or tiny homes can't house families with children. They're good for seniors, for single people, maybe for young couples that don't yet have children. But that's just so it's just one part of the solution. It doesn't deal with the rest of the solution. What we need is, and we emphasize this very much in Just Action, is we need mixed income housing that provides housing not just for the very poor and the very rich. Too often when we talk about affordable housing, we're using it as a euphemism for housing for the poor. We certainly need housing for the poor. But as I mentioned earlier, we need housing for the middle class as well, who cannot afford to live in homes that are now for sale because they're too expensive, much more expensive they were when their parents and grandparents bought those homes. That requires that there are federal subsidies for the poorest families. They're called Section 8 or the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit. The poorest families can get federal subsidies. Market rate, you can always charge market rate for housing. There is no subsidy available for the missing middle. And one of the things that we place great emphasis on in Just Action is the necessity of creating missing middle housing. And that requires local subsidies, either from local government or from state government, to permit truly diverse, racially and economically diverse communities. And we have examples of places that have done that successfully as well in Just Action.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I think that's all the time we have for today. Huge thank you to Richard Rothstein for being my guest. And thank you to everyone who called in and participated in our conversation today.
Thank you.
Richard Rothstein has written many books and articles on education policy and racial inequality, including his 2017 book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, and is co-author of Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation, Enacted Under the Color of Law, which he wrote with his daughter, Leah Rothstein. Thank you so much for joining me on A Public Affair. Thank you to producer Jade Aziri Ramos and our receptionist Mary Jo. Your regular host, Douglas Haynes, will be back. Thank you so much. Diamond the red, we come.
will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information.
And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Up next is Madison Bookbeat. Actually, you're going to hear the BBC headlines, then Madison Bookbeat. This week, host David Ahrens is talking with Tom Moskaller and Michael Williamson, co-authors of the book Bending Granite. Stay tuned. Take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level.
I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. Large groups of people are gathering in the Mexican town of Mazatlan, where a total solar eclipse is due to start in the next few minutes. The eclipse will move on to the United States and finish in Canada. The moon will perfectly block the sun and the sky will go pitch dark for 4 minutes. An estimated 31 million people will be in the path of the eclipse. Our correspondent, Emma Vardy, is at an event in Dallas to see the phenomenon.
It's a celestial party across North America. From Niagara Falls down to the west coast of Mexico, people have been traveling from all over the world to witness the spectacle, and they're hoping for clear skies. Total solar eclipses happen somewhere on the planet around once every 18 months,